Welcome to Food for Faith. This is John O'Connor. I'm delighted to bring to you today a recording of a lecture given by John Kinder. John is a great friend of Food for Faith, a participant, a regular participant in the homily studio. He's also a New Zealander, born in Invercargill, grew up in Palmerston North, but has spent most of his working life in Western Australia, in Perth, where he is now the Emeritus Professor of Italian Studies. He taught there for 33 years until his recent retirement. But among John's many interests is what I would call something of a passion for the Italian poet Dante Alighieri, who lived about 800 years ago now. And of course, we don't know too much about Dante here in Aotearoa and in the English-speaking world, because he was writing in Italian, and therefore the treasure that is his Divine Comedy is not easily available to us in the English-speaking world. So I'm delighted that John was willing to share with a great group who gathered in June of 2026, this year, in Christchurch to listen to this lecture, and I'm very happy to make this, with John's permission, available to all of you to listen as a podcast. So here is John Kinder reflecting on Dante Alighieri's Divine Comedy.
Well, good evening, everyone. Is this microphone working?
Yes.
Well, can you hear me?
Yes.
That's the point. Yeah, okay. Well, thanks very much to Christchurch friends for doing something quite unexpected, really, inviting me to come to Christchurch to talk to people I've never met before about Dante's Divine Comedy. It's quite an amazing thing to be here, and I'm very, very grateful that you've done this. It's a kind of a closing a circle for me in a way, because, as Brian said, I was born in Invercargill, but grew up on the other island and went to university in Wellington, and then Italy, and now Australia is home, and here I am back nearly in Invercargill, nearly bringing Dante's Divine Comedy to Invercargill. And I'm pleased to do this, really, because I feel like I'm repaying a debt, in a sense, because a boy from Invercargill and Palmerston North, I had a lot of good fortune in meeting a lot of good things along the way, and in particular a lot of good people who helped me to appreciate the good things that I came across. And so I've learnt a lot. Now I'm retired, I can sort of sit back and indulge myself in the things that I really enjoy, but I enjoyed everything, and this is a chance, I feel, to give back some of the what I've received along the journey. So, in what I'm going to do tonight, I have two aims, really, in talking about Dante's Divine Comedy. The bloke's name is Dante. Can you all repeat after me, please? Dante. It's not Dante, and it's not al dente. That's spaghetti. So he's Dante. Were you all okay with that? So I've got two objectives in what I'm going to do tonight. The first is to remind you that Dante is not the guy who wrote the Inferno. He wrote the Divine Comedy. The Inferno is just part one, and it's a lot of fun. There's a lot of blood, a lot of guts, a lot of suffering, a lot of drama. But then there's part two, which is Purgatory, which is beautiful. It's my favourite part. Then there's part three, which is Paradise, which will just blow your minds. It's heavenly, in fact. And so it's important, actually, to understand Dante's whole journey, because if you don't know the big picture, then the details won't make proper sense. So that's the first thing I want to get across tonight, that Dante wrote the Divine Comedy, not just a bit of it. And my second aim tonight is to convince you that you really want to read Dante's Divine Comedy. You may not know you do, but you do. And everyone can read it, and everyone can enjoy it. There are lots of good English translations around. And I've found that people are often a bit reluctant or put off by the fact that it's one of the great works of world literature, and how could I possibly read that? Well, The English poet T.S. Eliot wrote a lot about Dante in the 20th century, and he said the best way to read the Divine Comedy is to pick it up, open it on page one, and start reading. And keep reading. And keep reading. And if you come across things along the way, like the names of popes and emperors and saints and theological thing, let it go. Keep reading. You can go back and sort out the details later if you want to. But it's a story. It's a travel story. And so the best way to enjoy it is to pick it up and enjoy the trip. So they're my two objectives, to offer you the whole comedy and to convince you that you are going to go home now and read it. So where to start with this long story of Dante's comedy? I think that a good place to start is this painting. To understand the painting, we have to go to Florence for a second. So come with me for a second to Florence in Italy. And here in the centre of the city, you can see the great cathedral with the dome by Brunelleschi, Giotto's bell tower, and the baptistry in front, that little octagonal building where Dante was baptised. Now, if you go in the cathedral and walk up the main aisle, when you come to the crossing or the transept, you turn left and look up, you'll see that painting. So the painting of Dante and his poem is in the cathedral, which is kind of unusual because he's not a saint, he's not a holy person at all, and this is the most sacred building in the city. There's the painting again. You can see it's called Dante and his poem, and it was painted in 1465. Dante was born in Florence in 1265, so the painting was done for his 200th birthday, 200th anniversary of his birth. What can we see in the painting? Well, in the middle we can see a picture of Dante. He's standing there holding a copy of the Divine Comedy, open at page one. If you get up close, you can see it's actually page one with the words there. He's turning to his left, to that side, facing the city of Florence, the beloved city of Florence where he was born, where he lived until he was about 35, and where he was then exiled because of political stuff. The Italians do this very well. He was exiled from the city on pain of death. If he ever returned, he and his sons would be burnt at the stake, and all his possessions were confiscated. This is Florence today. And there's Florence in the picture. You can see it hasn't changed much since 1465. It's the same skyline. Now, Dante here is wearing a very stylish red cloak, which is actually a uniform. It's a uniform of what were called the priors of the city of Florence. Florence was governed at the stage by a group of six men who were elected every year to govern the city, and they were called priors. So Dante was a politician, and he's there in this painting in the cathedral of the city wearing the political office. On his head, you can see a green wreath of laurel wreaths. Laurel, an evergreen plant, is the plant sacred to Apollo, the god of poetry. And so the laurel wreath on his head shows that he is a poet. So by looking at what he's wearing and what's on his head, we know he's a politician and he's a poet. And like the green leaves of the laurel, his poetry will never die. Now, he's showing the book to the people of Florence, saying, "This is for you, I want you to read it." But with his right hand, he's pointing to the other side of the painting, towards me. And there he's pointing to what the book is about. The book is about the other world. Whoops. The other world, the afterlife. He's pointing to the other dimensions of reality, we might say. Hell down the corner, the mountain of purgatory, and paradise, the heavens going all around. These are the three parts of the Divine Comedy: hell, purgatory, and paradise. So Dante wanted to write something about the way he understood the world and what's good and bad and right and wrong and what happens when we die. But he chose not to write an essay or a treatise. He chose to write a story, a travel story. So what we're going to do now is follow Dante on this journey through these three parts, hell, purgatory, paradise, and see what happens to him along the way. He was born in 1265. He says the journey happened in 1300, so he was 35 years old, which is half of 70, right? And 70 years and 10 is the average or expected lifespan, so he's halfway in his life. And the journey, by the way, also happened at Easter, but we could go into details like this perhaps later. How does it start? It starts like this. These are the opening lines. Midway in the journey of our life, I came to myself in a dark wood, for the straight way was lost. Nel mezzo del cammin di nostra vita, mi ritrovai per una selva oscura che la dritta via era smarrita. Dante says he came to his senses in a dark forest. He's been through some personal crisis. He doesn't say what it was, but we know from Dante's life that he'd been through some emotional relationship crises, religious crises, philosophical crises. He's in some very, very dark space. He comes to his senses, wakes up in a dark forest. And from the forest, he can look out and see in the distance a mountain, a beautiful mountain, with the rising sun of a new day, brings hope. The rising sun is shining on the top of the mountain. So Dante knows that that's where he wants to be. That's the place where all his desires are going to be fulfilled. That's where he's going to be happy. So he sets out towards the mountain to climb to where he's going to be happy. But immediately, three beasts come and block his path. A lion, a leopard, and a lynx. And there's Dante, you see, in the middle with his hands up saying, oh gosh, now I'm really in trouble. So he starts to head back to the dark wood and he's lost all hope of ever being happy. And just by the way, I'm going to show you pictures from lots of different time periods because lots of artists have read the story and have interpreted it their way. It's been around for a long time and there's lots of different interpretations. So I hope that you appreciate the different artistic styles. While Dante's heading back to get away from these three beasts and go back to the dark wood, now in the middle of despair, he sees someone, the second person you see in the middle of the painting. This is Virgil, the great poet of Roman antiquity. So Virgil's come back from the dead to help Dante get out of trouble. And Virgil says to Dante, yes, you're right, that mountain is the place where you'll be happy. That is the place where you will be eternally and completely fulfilled. But the way to the top of the mountain is not as easy as you think. You can't just go there and take happiness any time you want, any way you want. To go up the mountain, first you've got to climb down. To go out of yourself, you first got to journey in. He says, I'll take you there, but are you ready for the real thing? This is a journey for grown-ups. So Dante says, yeah, sure, off we go. And so off they go together, starting their journey through hell and then towards the mountain. So this shows the corner of the painting we saw before. This is a glimpse of what the gate of hell looks like. This is the famous gate. You know, everyone knows the quote, abandon all hope, ye who enter here. It's written on top of the gate here. The gate of hell, Dante says, is always open and it's very wide. There's room for everyone. But if you look at the people who've obviously just arrived and they're on their way down, There are devils and demons and nasties of all sorts making them as uncomfortable as possible, but no one's fighting back. They seem to be going quite willingly. They're not being pushed down. And this is one of the first points that Dante makes that I think that challenges us modern people. Dante says that at the moment of death, the soul, we, will know where we're supposed to go. We'll know whether we've chosen to be with God or whether we've chosen to turn our back on God. We'll know. We'll be sent to the appropriate place of hell or heaven, but we'll go there willingly because we'll know that that's the right place for us. Interesting. It's almost as if we judge ourselves. So Dante, with Virgil, goes through the gate and begins to go down hell. Hell is a huge pit running down to the centre of the earth. There are 9 levels. And we'll see as we go along that numbers are very important for Dante. The numbers matter. There are 9 levels. Each level is for the punishment of a particular sin. So whatever sin you excelled in, that's the level that you'll be sent to. And so Dante now walks around the pit all the way down the bottom. And he meets people as he goes along and has conversations with souls. Who are you and where are you from and what did you do and why are you here? The sins get worse as they go down. So the sins at the top are the less important ones and the sins at the bottom are the really bad ones. And let me just say, on a personal note, I remember when I first read this when I was 20 at Vic in Wellington, I was a young Catholic chap wrestling with a few questions of Catholic morality. And when I discovered that lust was at the top of the pit, so it wasn't actually much of a problem, I thought, this is the guy for me. But it wasn't quite as simple as that. But that was, anyway, just keep that to yourselves. So the sins get worse and the punishments get worse. And Dante's devised a wonderful system of fitting the punishment to the sin. So each crime has got its own particular punishment. And the punishment fits the crime. Actually, the punishment is the crime. Let me show you what I mean. Here's the circle, the level of lust. And the punishment for people who sinned against lust is that they are blown around by this wind, which changes direction continuously. And they're blown around and buffeted backwards and forwards and up and down and forever. It's as if Dante's saying, ha, you think lust is a lot of fun, don't you? You think lust is exciting, makes you feel like a grown-up, kind of liberating. All you are when you sin against lust is you're turning yourself into something, a being, that just gets blown around any old time you get an urge. You get an itch and you scratch. That's all you are, and that's all lust is. Like he's taken the superficial attraction of it to see what the sin actually consists of. The next level he comes to is the level of gluttony. So people who sinned against gluttony basically turn into beasts who grovel around in the mud. It rains on them, continually cold rain. They have kind of gadflies that bite their bodies, and so the blood drips to the ground, and worms come and eat the blood and guts and stuff. So it's as if he's saying, gluttony feels great, doesn't it? Like, you know, oh, one more slice, one more, yeah. But actually, you're turning yourself into that. That's what gluttony is. It feels good, but really, that's what it is. Dante has an amazing imagination, and so this is one of the most favourite punishments, certainly with students. Students love this. A fair way down, there's a place where popes and bishops are punished for selling church favours. So the corrupt popes, and there were a few in Italy at the time, corrupt popes and bishops would sell off favours or indulgences or things to people and pocket the proceedings. Now, popes and bishops that did that are punished like this. They're turned upside down and buried in these tombs that go vertically down into the ground. Why are they buried upside down? Well, Dante says, if you think about what's more important, the spiritual things of life or the material things of life, you know, God's things or money, obviously God's things are on top and money is below it. It's less important. These guys turned everything upside down and put money and gain ahead of God's things. So they've been turned upside down. At the first Pentecost, you remember, the Holy Spirit came and rested on the heads of the apostles and Mary as tongues of flame. These blokes were ordained with the Holy Spirit to be priests, bishops, popes. They've abused that. And so they've got tongues of fire, all right, on their feet. And he says that each new pope that comes along is rammed down on top of the other ones. And so there's a series of them. It's fantastic. The last punishment I'll show you is in the very, very pit of hell. So as he goes down, it gets hotter and hotter and hotter. But the last area is freezing cold. It's turned to ice. So the whole place is fire and ice. Why is it ice? Well, the worst sin that Dante could think of, the sin that's punished at the bottom, the worst sin is the sin of treachery, betrayal, betraying people who put their faith in you. What's so bad about betrayal? Isn't murder worse? Well, we could, yeah, you could talk about what's worse. But see, Dante's not just interested in, as it were, God's perspective on things. He knows that what matters is this life. If I betray you, if we're in a family or an organization or a city or a country and I betray you, you can't trust me anymore. We can't live together. We can't build anything. Our social life is over. So for Dante, that's the worst kind of sin that people can do, is to betray those who put their trust in them. To do that, you've got to have a heart that is as cold as ice. And so the punishment for people that did that is that they are buried in a lake of ice. In fact, if you look at the surface of the lake here, you can see bits sticking out. They're the heads of the sinners. And what happens is, one part there, the sinners can feel the pain of being trapped in ice, and so they weep out of pain. But then Dante says he sees the tear appear out of their eyelid and it instantly turns to ice. So these people have got ice blocks inside their eye, which is making them even more suffer. That breaks off, another one, and so it goes on and on and on. Wonderful imagination. What keeps us cold? Well, the devil, there's the devil. The devil keeps it cold. He's this huge monster. And Dante calculates how tall he was. He's got bat's wings, which are constantly moving. And the wind of the bat's wings is keeping the lake frozen. Dante sees the devil. He has three faces. It's a kind of obscene parody of the Blessed Trinity. Three faces. And in his three mouths are the three worst traitors in the history of the world, according to Dante. Two of them are Brutus and Cassius, who betrayed Julius Caesar. They're on the sides. And the one in the middle is Judas Iscariot, who betrayed Jesus. So when Dante comes to the bottom of the pit, now, Dante in the red and Virgil on the blue jump onto the devil's hairy side and start to climb down the bottom of the devil. He's told how hell was formed. How come there's this huge pit in the middle of the earth? What happened was, when God created the angels, the brightest of them, Lucifer, the light carrier, rebelled against God. So God punished Lucifer by casting him out of heaven. And remember, at this time, people thought the earth was the center of the solar system, but the center of the universe. And so heaven was the furthest part away from the earth. God threw Lucifer out of heaven towards earth. Lucifer hit the earth with such speed that he wedged himself in through the earth, creating this amazing hole as he went, and got stuck in the middle. All the earth that he pushed ahead of him as he went through got shoved out the other side and formed a mountain in the southern hemisphere. The hole is the pit of hell, and the mountain is Mount Purgatory. By Dante's calculations, it should be somewhere southeast of Fiji, but no one's found it yet. That's where it should be. So Dante jumps on the devil's hairy flank and starts to climb down. And then something really weird happens, because he starts to climb down, and then he realizes that he's actually climbing up, because he's passed through the center of gravity of the earth. So he starts to climb down and keeps going, but now, from a southern hemisphere point of view, he's actually climbing up. So he climbs out the other side and comes out in the middle of the southern ocean at the base of a huge mountain. Hell was full of darkness, but when he comes out at the foot of this mountain, it's the dawn of a new day. He's full of hope. Now, this is Mount Purgatory from the painting from before. Let's be very clear about what purgatory is and purgatory is not. Purgatory is not a second chance. It's not a place where you go if you, 51% give you... No. Dante says, at the end of time, that when time and space cease to exist, there'll only be two ways of being. There'll be being with God, being without God. Nothing in between. But most of us, when we die, Dante says, even if we're going to heaven, we're not ready yet for heaven. Our sins, he says, have been forgiven. But we need to purge ourselves, not of the sins, because they've been forgiven. We need to purge ourselves of the memory of sin, or the ongoing effects of sin on our soul. You are what you eat, we say these days. You are what you do, Dante says. You commit certain sins that forms you as a person. And even if the sin's been forgiven, you've changed because of it. So the souls who are on their way to heaven have to purge themselves in purgatory. They've got to climb the mountain. There are nine levels. Again, nine levels. Two at the bottom, and then after the gate, there are seven levels, one for each of the seven deadly sins. Now in hell, you get sent to the level where you belong because you did that sin here. In purgatory, everyone climbs all the levels because we've all sinned against pride and gluttony and lust and avarice and all the rest of them. You can see that the gate of purgatory is narrow and shut. Hell was open and wide. There's an angel there with a sword. And the sword of the angel carves, nice contemporary of Japanese, is it called manga or something? There's Japanese stuff. The angel carves the letter P seven times in Dante's forehead. P stands for the Latin word peccatum, peccat, which means sin. So one P for each of the seven deadly sins. Dante has to walk up the mountain too and purge himself of the memory of these sins. Along the way, he has conversations like he did in hell. So this is the first deadly sin, pride, the worst of them. And Dante walks around and has a conversation with someone who's purging themselves of pride. Again, you can see the system of punishment and crime. People who, to purge ourselves of pride, we have to walk around carrying huge boulders on our shoulders, which make us bend over into the position of humility. So they're learning humility by what they have to do. And even Dante, to talk to that bloke, has to bend down and learn humility. In purgatory, Dante's beginning to understand more and more the way things actually are. And in one conversation here, he's told what good and evil actually are, and what makes us human. What makes us human, he says, is that we have the freedom to choose how to use our reason to direct our desires. We have the freedom to use our reason to direct our desires. Desire for Dante is good. Now, growing up in New Zealand in the 60s and 70s, desire was not a word that we associated with good things. For Dante, desire is just love, basically. And the whole universe is about, he says that apples desire the ground. That's why they fall out of a tree. They don't fall up, they fall down because they desire the ground. Desire, for him, is just the movement of the universe. So desires are good. But humans have been given the power of reason to decide how to use our desires. What things should I desire? What things should I not? How much should I desire this thing or that thing? And I decide that using my reason. And thirdly, I'm free. God's given us complete freedom. Just watch the news on TV and you can see how free humans are. We're free to make a complete mess of things or to use our reason for other purposes. So Dante learns that being human means having the freedom to use our reason to direct our desires. He had learnt this earlier on, actually, but he wasn't ready for it. He had to wait till he gets here. Because back in the circle of the lustful, there's Dante on the right with Virgil, looking at this pair of lovers. They were in an incestuous relationship, and there was a murder and it got very nasty, and these two are condemned to be together. Now, when they were there, this is back in hell, Dante said to Virgil, what actually did they do? Like, why are they here? And as if he's saying, are they here because they broke a law? Because they broke their marriage vow? Because they broke one of the Ten Commandments? And Virgil says, no, that's not why they're here. Those are all important. It's important to be faithful to your wife, keep the commandments. They're good things to do. But that's not the point. Here's the point. And this is what Virgil says to Dante. They are here because they are carnal sinners, sinners of the flesh, who make reason subject to desire. So what these people, what the lustful did was, they made their desire control their reason. I want that, I'm going to have it. And it's not the having it or the doing it, it's the thing that they've betrayed what it is to be human. To be human means you've got a reason to control your desires, not the other way around. That's why they're in hell. Not because they broke a commandment, not because they broke a vow, but because they betrayed the humanity that God gave them. So Dante learns these things as he climbs up the seven levels, and every time he finishes a level, he finds that one of the peas on his forehead gets brushed away. There's an angel actually brushes his forehead with his wing, and one of the peas goes off. So down to 6, 5, 4. And every time a pea goes, because he's just purged that sin, he feels lighter. The mountain's getting steeper, but he can climb more easily because he's lighter. At the top of the mountain, Dante comes to a place where people are back the way they were in the Garden of Eden. So there's Adam and Eve, as they were before they ate the apple. Dante's there too. So he's purged himself of the memory of all the bad things he did and the memory of the good things he should have done. He's forgotten that now. He's free. He's light and he's free, and now he can fly into heaven. And so he does. And here's the painting again. You can see there are 9 heavens again. And the painter is very specific. You can see there, next to each of the planets, there's an astrological symbol. So I think that's Saturn, Mercury, Mars. It's all very precise. To go through heaven, Dante gets a new guide. Virgil was a pagan. So he could take Dante through hell and that. But heaven's not for pagans. So Dante gets a new guide, a woman called Beatrice, who was a real woman that he loved, Dante loved, and lost. Dante finds with Beatrice that he can move through heaven simply by wishing to move. Whatever he wants to do, he can do. The sins are gone. The memory of sin is gone. He's completely free. His desire and his reason are completely aligned, and he can move simply by wanting to. Dante's paradise is an amazing place. We today, I think we have, you know, very sad and boring stereotypes of what heaven is, you know, clouds, old men, white beards. That Dante's paradise is an amazing experience of light. All the people he meets there, and he meets lots of people, has conversations, they're all clothed in light, he says. It's a place of colour in perfect harmony. It's a place of sound, of music in perfect harmony. And it's a place of constant movement, circular movement. All of Dante's movements are all circular because a circle is perfect, has no beginning and no end. And so Dante travels through paradise and comes at the end of his journey into the presence of the mystery of eternal being, what we usually call God. And then the poem stops. And as soon as you get to the end, the first thing you want to do is go back and start reading it again. Because when you've got the whole picture, you want to go back and understand the details in their context. Now, I'll just talk for probably another 5 minutes. I want to say three things, just looking at the whole Divine Comedy, and offer my thoughts on, firstly, why Dante wrote the story in the first place, what he learns, and how he learns it. So why, what, and how. Firstly, why did he write this amazing story? Well, he says why he wrote. He says, I'm writing this to help people move from misery to happiness. That's why he's in the painting there showing the book to the people of Florence. Look, read this and you'll be happy. Happy now. Not a pie in the sky when you die. Happy now. The way to be happy now is to think about right and wrong and good and evil, my desires, my reason, my freedom. And so all these amazing places, the 9 circles of hell with their different sins. The nine levels of purgatory. The nine spheres of paradise. Why nine? Nine because it's three squared. And three is the number of the Trinity. Yeah? All these amazing places, though, you could get the impression this is like medieval science fiction. Some kind of amazing trip into some other world that's not actually this world at all. In fact, I think, though, this story is not about the other world at all, actually. It's about this world. It's not about the afterlife. It's about this life, here and now. It's a journey through the human heart, exploring and showing us all our potential for self-destruction or for redemption. I think Dante is saying, I can turn my life into a hell. And I know I can, actually, if I try hard enough. I can make the lives of my loved ones hellish, too. Just ask my wife. She's not here, so I can say that. But I can also build heaven on earth with those that I love. And Dante, through talking about hell, purgatory, and paradise, is asking me to think about what am I building now, here and now? Am I making my life a heaven, or am I making it a hell? So the story is known as the Divine Comedy. Dante didn't call it Divine Comedy. He just called it a comedy. Maybe we should say a word about that. For the ancient Greeks, there was only two kinds of stories. There were stories that started happy and finished sad. They're called tragedies. Happy to sad. There are stories that start sad and finish happy. They're called comedies. That's why it's called a comedy. Someone called it Divine Comedy, but really it's a human comedy, actually. It's about us. So that's why. Secondly, what does Dante learn in this journey? I think what he learns is that our destiny is for happiness and for infinity. We are made for the infinite. Reality, ultimately, is good. And it's all for me. The story's in three parts: hell, purgatory, paradise. The last word of each part is the same. The last word of hell is the word stelle, the stars. Last word of purgatory, stars. Last word of paradise, stars. Again, three. Because we are made for the stars. And the stars are there for me. We're made for happiness. But our journey, like Dante's journey to the top of the mountain, is not some quick and easy fix. I'll get there when I want to and I'll just take it on my terms. No. To reach happiness, I've got to do the same journey that Dante did. I've got to journey into myself to know myself. I've got to recognize my own need. I have to realize I cannot make it alone. Dante, on his journey, is never alone. He's always accompanied. Happiness is not something I can give myself. It's got to come from somewhere else. And the most basic thing I know about myself, if I look at myself, is that I am not making myself in this moment. I'm not giving myself being. I'm not giving myself breath. It's coming to me from somewhere. Life's given to me. Therefore, I depend on whatever it is that's giving me life. And at the deepest heart of myself, I find the presence of a mysterious other. An other who made me and is making me in every instant. And so the most profound thing I can say about myself is, I am you who make me. I am you who make me. That, I think, is what he learns. And finally, how does Dante learn all this stuff? Well, this is the really interesting part, because everything he learns in the journey, he learns through an encounter with another person. He's got his guides. He's got Virgil guiding him along. He's got Beatrice. Then up in top of heaven, he's got St. Bernard. He meets people. They swap stories. Now, Dante had read a lot of books. He'd studied a lot. But he needed these encounters with these other people to help him really understand what those books were about. And he learns the truth about himself on a journey. And that, I think, is good for us, because we 21st century people can get impatient and we can think that we want the answers now. We can get almost anything on our phone any second we want. I want the answer to life now. But Dante, as a Christian, knew that what Jesus offers people was not a miracle but a journey. And the journey is one we are designed to make with others. We're not designed to make the journey alone. Let me make that point with a final observation. At the beginning, Virgil says to Dante, come on, I'm taking you on a journey. But he does not say, Dante does not say, I'll show you hell, purgatory, paradise. What he says is, I'll show you the people in hell. I'll show you the people in purgatory. I'll show you the people in paradise. Dante comes to understand that the way to God is through his relationship with other people. And the way to have relationship with other people is through his journey to God. This becomes crystal clear in my favourite moment of the whole story. And Genevieve asked me what's my favourite line of the poem. Well, here it is. Towards the top of paradise, Dante finished the seventh heaven of paradise. He sees that to get up to the next one, he's got to climb an enormous stairway of light. He said it was the colour of gold struck by sunlight. And there's an infinite number of angels and blessed souls moving up and down and having a gay old time. As he's there, down the bottom here, you can see, one of the souls comes over to meet him. Dante can't tell who he is because he's just all covered in light. And so straight away, Dante asks him a question, sort of a theological question. How come only one of you guys came to meet me? What about the others? And the soul says, don't worry about it. God knows the answer. We don't ask the questions. We obey the answers. But then Dante gets a bit toey about it. And here's another picture of the same thing. Here's a beautiful illustration of the same scene. You can see the staircase up and down. You can see Dante in the brown. That's Beatrice. And here is the soul. Now, the soul here has been painted in a certain way. It shows us two things about him. One, he's a monk, because he's got monk's clothes on. And secondly, he was a cardinal, because he's wearing a red hat. So this is actually St. Peter Damian, who was an Italian monk, lived a little bit before Dante became a cardinal. But Dante doesn't know that. He just thinks this. He's this soul. And look at Dante's finger. He's wagging his finger. The other guy's wagging his finger. And Dante's saying, but hang on, it doesn't make sense. If you came down, what about the others? And why do you do what God does? And they have a bit of an old ding-dong. Then the soul says to Dante, hey. Well, he doesn't say hey. He would if he was Australian. He'd say, hey. We're souls in paradise. We don't understand. But our fulfillment is to do the divine will. You're not even here. And you're going to argue the toss about why this one. Relax. And then Dante says these lines that for me are the centre of the whole journey. He says, his words restrained me so. His words so restrained me that I left the question. So he stops wagging his finger and arguing the toss. And I drew back to ask the spirit humbly who he was. And then the saint tells him they have a conversation. I think this is crucial because Dante's learned one of the deepest truths about life, that journeying to God is possible. It is possible to journey to God. It is possible to reach complete happiness, provided we give up the claim to do it on our terms. And instead, journey to God by encountering other human beings in humility and love. And this, I think, is one of the lessons that remains with us when we read the story. Because I think these days, particularly, when we meet another person, there's a temptation, isn't there, to sort of check them up and size them up. Where are you from? What ethnicity are you? What party do you vote for? What do you think about migration? What do you think about Trump? What do you think about... And we're putting the person into boxes before we've even asked them their name. And I think Dante is saying here in this journey, it will be better for us too if we left the question. We can come back to the question about policy, blah, blah, blah. But let's leave the question and draw back and ask the other that we encounter humbly who they are.
John, thank you very much. That certainly inspired me to go and get a copy and start reading at page one. With your indulgence, we'll take a few minutes for
questions.
Would anyone like to raise a question and bring the mic down and make it? There we go. Well done.
I'm not sure I trust the mic, but my question was just... recommended translations in English.
Oh, translation. Look, these days there are so many English translations that they're all good. They're all good. There are some, if you're looking for names of translators, Robin Fitzpatrick, Charles Singleton, or Robert Hollander. Now, these guys have done what are called parallel texts. So you open the book, and on the left-hand side is Dante, and on the right-hand side is the translation. And there'll be a whole lot of notes about who this king and pope and blah, blah, blah. And they do it very well. So Fitzpatrick, Hollander, and the third one. Who was the third one?
Singleton.
Huh?
Singleton.
Singleton, Charles Singleton. Clive James, one of the great Australians, did his own translation a few years ago. And it's amazing. What James did was... First of all, he translated it into rhyming English poetry, so it sounds like it was written in English. And there are no footnotes. Now, the way he got around the footnotes was, if Dante says, for example, like when Dante meets a pope called Celestine V, who resigned, just like Benedict XVI, and it was a scandal then, like it was a scandal now. It is in hell, actually, Celestine V. I don't think Dante would have put Benedict. Well, I hope he would. Any case, all Dante says is, I saw the soul of him who made the great refusal. Full stop. That's all he says. And, of course, you know, back in 1330, everyone's going, oh, of course, yeah, the one who made the great refusal. Oh, yes, of course, Pope Celestine V. Now, these days, we don't know who the hell made the great refusal, so we've got to have a footnote that describes it. So in the translations you'll read, it'll say, the one who made the great refusal, footnote, that was Pope so-and-so. Clive James says, Dante says, I saw the soul of Pope Celestine V, the monk who was forced to be pope and then resigned, and blah, blah, blah. So he puts it all into the story. It's not Dante, because that's not how Dante did it, but it's very effective. And what it means is you can pick it up and read it without having to look up atlases and stuff. So it's a question of taste.
James, interesting you mentioned James. Where would you see him? Has he passed purgatory yet? He had a very interesting life. Maybe his writing, this translation, he's being guided by Dante higher up to a better place.
There's a point.
For a while later, he's going down.
Well, we'll assume he's going up, shall we?
I think so. How tired do you think he is for doing the translation?
Yeah, lots of brownie points. Dante, you know, because medieval person, and they, Dante was living at the time when they invented universities. They were really trying to understand the universe, and they believed that the universe was rational. That's why all these numbers, everything makes sense in numbers and so on. So he calculates how long you've got to spend in purgatory, the type of sin, how many times you committed it, it's all worked out. But another line I was talking to Genevieve about before, see, Dante really, really destabilizes us modern people because we think we've got things under control and clear, but and what would he know, medieval Italian? But there's one point there early on in purgatory where he meets this guy who's a really, really bad guy, like a really rape, murder, pillage, you know, he did the lot. And he was a contemporary of Dante's. And, he, and Dante says, oh, you're in purgatory. That's a surprise. And the guy says, well, yeah. He says, when I died, this devil came on my left shoulder ready to take me off to hell. And I thought, oh, fair enough, game's up. But then a good angel came on my right shoulder and said, no, he's ours. And the devil said, but don't you know he did this and this and this and this and this? And the good angel says, yes, but when he died, he shed one little tear of remorse. And that outbalanced all the murder and rape and pillage. Now, he may still be in purgatory now because he's got a lot of things to purge on. But the our principles of mercy and justice and what's fair, Dante can really challenge us on that, and I think it's good for us.
Another question.
How do people, can you hear me?
Yes.
How do they react to all this faith?
Now you mean? Oh, look, they say that... or someone said that the further we get away from Dante, the more people want to discover him because he's so different to us, but actually just the same as us, trying to answer the same questions. People are reading Dante all the time, and they're interpreting Dante in different ways. I mean, I showed you a picture of Japanese manga or whatnot. There's a translation of Dante by someone in California where hell is a parking lot outside a supermarket. Purgatory is a building of Google or something. People just do weird stuff. And quite frankly, it doesn't blow my hair back. But people are reading this again today to try and understand now. And that's the point. You don't read Dante to try and understand Italy in 1300. You read him to understand yourself. And that's why he keeps on being read.
To understand yourself or ourselves?
That's the perfect question. At the end of the day, I'm responsible for my own actions, right? So it's me. But I'm not expected to make the journey alone. We're all responsible for our own individual decisions. All of us. That's what Dante would say. But we're also all called to work it through together. I hope that wasn't a politician's answer, but...
No, because I was thinking about climate change.
You mean in terms of individual responsibility and social...
I've just been thinking about, if Dante knew about climate change, how he would weave that into his logic. You may not have the answer off the top of your head, but I think it's interesting. I suppose the question is relates to the other one about how people apply it today.
Yeah. Well, I used to ask students, you know, to put what would be the order of sins in hell? What do they think would be the order of sins in hell? And I showed the students once a film of an Italian actor. Took a group of people to a slum in the slum's called Kibuyu or something in Lagos, I think. Nigeria, is it Lagos in Nigeria? This huge slum, and he taught the comedy to these kids, and these kids acted it out in the streets of the slum, and they had an order of sin. And the people at the bottom of their hell were adults who took children. Because, of course, that's the reality they live. So, you know, each person that reads it with their own... Yeah, Dante doesn't talk about climate change, but he does talk about the created world as God's gift. Not necessarily just to us, but God's gift of himself. And so a sin against the created world is a sin against the one who created it. Yeah. Brian, I'll let you...
I'll take this gentleman at the back.
I think there's a gentleman at the, in the corner as well, at the back.
Sorry.
Yes.
So you, as he travels through hell, and I'm thinking of the icicles there at the bottom layer, people are suffering, they're in pain, but then when he's moving through purgatory, there's still pain and suffering as the people are humble. But is Dante suggesting that in purgatory there is it's a joyful pain? Is he suggesting that because they're filled with hope, that there is that sense of I'm enduring pain, but it's good. I'm moving up the mountain. I'm moving to something better.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. Everyone in all three parts accepts the situation because they know that it's right. But in purgatory, as you correctly say, people are moving. No one's moving well, they're moving around, but in the same spot, the same in heaven. In purgatory, they're moving from here to there. And the punishments are part of that journey. Yep.
How was that received, like, while he's alive? And was it well, like, my church, my culture, was well received?
How was Dante received at the time? Yeah, good question. He actually put one pope in hell before he was dead. It's great. I mean, it's great. No, I'm saying it's great, but it's kind of shows he's got no fear of anything. It was never banned officially, but places like seminaries, for example, would never teach it, and schools for a long time never taught it in Italy because it was just too free. But among the people, it was hugely popular straight away. So about 50 years later, the poet Boccaccio, the Italian writer Boccaccio, started this practice. Every week he would get up in a place in the middle of Florence and he would read one canto. So the whole thing is in 100 canto, 100 chapters. He would read a chapter and explain it to the people, everyone in Florence, because they couldn't read, most of them, so he would explain it to them. You know, hugely popular.
Was it like high culture at the time, or was it sort of written...
Yeah, look, it is high culture because it's extremely sophisticated the way it's written. And yet, you know, I've met Italian people who can quote vast tracts, but I just learned it from school. And it's also because Italians today speak a language, Italian, that's quite close to the one that Dante did or spoke. It hasn't changed all that much. Children read Inferno in year 10. Purgatory in year 11, Paradise in year 12. So you just kind of know it.
I just want to thank you for what you've done here. I really feel like it touches deeply. And as you said at the beginning, it does, I think, open the appetite to go read. As you said, there was a thing you were saying, you were talking about how to go up, one must go down, and to go out, one must go in. And I wonder if you could develop a little bit more on that. But I find that very interesting.
Well, I don't know much about psychology, but what I do know, that's what people say today. You know, the answer to your problems is not to rush out and do something, but to look in. And Dante... At the beginning, Dante is not ready to understand all the things that he sees and hears. He's not ready. He grows in the journey, so he's not the same person at the end as he was at the beginning. Not just because of what he's seen, but because of he's growing himself by going into himself. So in the circle of the of the lustful, for example, Dante clearly had a problem with lust. He talks about it quite a lot. And when that couple that I showed you, the couple embracing there, they tell their story, Dante faints. He passes out. He's obviously overcome and wrestling with something in himself. But then, by the time he gets to the bottom of hell, he's walking along the lake, the frozen lake, and he kicks something and realizes it's the head of a soul sticking out of the frozen lake. And he says, serves you right. So he's growing in his own understanding of, I guess you might say, loving the sinner but hating the sin. Before, he couldn't make that distinction. He has to learn it. And he has to learn it by looking at himself, and we learn quite a bit about him along the way. But also all these sins he sees and all these punishments, it's all for him to measure himself and say, well, where am I in that?
And those few questions brought to an end the evening session, but there was a final request. Someone asked right at the end if John could choose and then recite in the original language just a couple of key verses, and John was very happy to do that, and so we finish with those verses.
Well, these three here, these are the most important lines in my understanding, and it says in Italian, it says, "Si mi percorse le parole sue, ch'io lasciai la questione e mi ritrassi umilmente." No, "e mi ritrassi a dimandarla umilmente chi fue." If you listen to the sound of it, when he talks about his words restrained me that I left the question, it's very rough sounds. "Si mi percosse le parole sue, ch'io lasciai la questione." It's all boom, 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 because they've been arguing. Then when he draws back, listen to the sound. "E mi ritrassi a dimandarla umilmente chi fue." Just changes completely. Isn't that amazing?